Welcome to Afterlife of Trees, Popular Woodworking's podcast for woodworkers and makers. I'm David Teal, video producer for Popular Woodworking, and your host for today. In this episode, I visited with Mark Adams, founder of the Mark Adams School of Woodworking, just outside of Indianapolis, Indiana. The school is celebrating its 25th year, and we took the opportunity to talk with Mark about his decision to start a woodworking school. So, 25th anniversary, right?
This is the big year.
What do you remember from the first year when you opened the school?
The very first year, I taught all the classes myself. I had no staff, no backup, no support. I did 16 classes, took 10 people in those 16 classes, and had 160 people here. And at the end of those 16 weeks, it nearly killed me. So going into the next year, I decided I needed to bring in more help and more support, people to watch the equipment. So the second year, I brought in a handful of other instructors, such as Bob Flexner and Dr. Bruce Hoadley and Kelly Mailer. And with those people, we then started to grow into the third year and into the fourth year, and it just kept going from there.
You've grown every year?
Every year.
And this year, after 25 years, how many students look into classes?
This year, we'll probably have between 3,500 and 4,000 people that will come here from all over the world. To date, we've had probably over 34,000 people come here and attend workshops. So it continues to grow and continues to get bigger and even more fun.
You described the school as a destination, as a vacation spot. Tell me a little about that.
Well, when I started, my original intention was hopefully that this could be a place for people to come that were already in woodworking, professional woodworkers. And pretty quickly I realized that that just wasn't the people that were coming. And they happened to be people that were professional people in their real world. Average age is probably 55 years old, very successful people. And woodworking was a hobby or a passion of theirs, and they were willing to pursue it. And so for me, as these people came in, I realized that they were here on vacation. So my philosophy changed partly from a woodworking school to a vacation destination. And that has been our focus, is to accommodate people as though they're on vacation. While they're here, if they happen to learn about woodworking, then that's a great thing too. But they're our guests, and so we treat them that way.
You're very fond of the Disney concept, and I think part of that is be our guest concept and treat the person well.
Well, the whole thing about the Disney concept is they've been so successful in what they do. And from a business standpoint, looking at how, again, they treat their customers is exactly the philosophy we try to bring in here. We try to accommodate them in every way we can. We make it a pleasant experience. We always want, when they come, there to be changes from one year to the next. We try to do what we can in terms of our food services. My staff works with a servant's heart. And there are just things that we do that I think make it more personal and a real experience. So when people leave here, they desire to come back. And that's the goal, and that's what Disney does. They cause people to want to come back year after year after year. And we've come pretty close to that. We have about a 90% return rate. So our goal is, if somebody comes here, we know, or we hope, or we strive to make it a place where they want to come back.
You still teach?
I'm going to do 15 weeks this year, or 15 workshops this year. So it's what I enjoy doing. More than anything, I enjoy the teaching side of it.
Cool. When did you put the ice cream machine in?
You know, I wish I could have an exact year. I think more importantly would be how many ice cream cones we served over the years. But it's been a big part of our program, and that's why people come, really, is for the ice cream. It's free, so that's a part of the deal.
So your first year, how many buildings? Just one? Where was it?
Actually, we had, this used to be my cabinet shop. I was a furniture manufacturer, did architectural millwork, stairway, stair componentry. And that business grew really big. And there were a few things that happened along the way that caused me to come back to where I am today, which is education. And with that, we had the original facility, which were two buildings. But we only had the school in the one building to start with. And then as the years went on and as we started to grow year by year, then we started to have the second building. Then we added additions to those two buildings. Then we added another building. Then we added additions to that building. Then we added a new facility. And this is just the beginning. We'll continue to grow.
You've added a tech section this year. That's the expansion?
Well, the expansion for us actually took place last year.
Okay.
And with that, since we serve food to everybody, one of our big challenges was trying to figure out how to feed people. We could have 100 people here on any one given day. And because of that, our cafeteria, first of all, the kitchen where the ladies prepare it, was really small. and we had to get them more space. The area that we were serving the food in was small. We could only take about 40 people in there at a time, so we'd have to rotate classes in and out. So we really needed a bigger place to eat. We also needed to do something with our lays. Because of our lays, the way that they were, we were having to put them up, take them down, put them up, take them down for classes, because we didn't have it set up to run lathe classes all summer long. And we wanted to be able to do that. So those two things caused us to ultimately have to build a new facility. And because we've always been a little tech savvy, we have to do everything from the hand skills, but we also have to do things that intrigue people today that have the backgrounds to be able to do things with automated equipment. So we also added a tech center. So our new facility accommodates the lunch program, the turning center, and the tech center.
Tell me about your master's program.
You know, I think our master's program is by far the most credible program, I'm going to go as far as saying, on Earth. And the reason I can say that is because the quality of the people who teach here are unparalleled anywhere else. Because we're a technique school, we're not really a project school. I mean, you can come and make a grandfather clock here, but that's not really what we do. This summer, we're going to offer 240 workshops. And of those workshops we're going to offer, maybe 10 or 15 are very project specific. The rest of them are about technique. With technique, you can make anything. But with a project, you make one thing. But because we have techniques, we have a better curriculum that we can put together. So with our curriculum, we've chose classes such as joinery, veneering, carving, turning, finishing, hand skills. We have an apprenticeship workshop. We have design classes. And we were able to take those core group of classes and convert them into what we call our master's program. It's 11 total weeks. Don't have to do it, and I wouldn't recommend somebody try to do it in a year or even two. We had one gentleman who completed it a few years ago. It took him 19 years to get through it. So it's not about getting there as quickly as you can, but there are those requirements as our core part of the program. Now, why is it so good? It's good because every class is taught by a different person. Our instructors at Teacher are the best craftsmen of modern time, period. I mean, I'll go out of my way to bring in the absolute best for everything. So what happens in those 11 weeks is you're exposed to somebody doing a finishing class who is the best at finishing. If you take the chair making class, you're with somebody who's a world-renowned chair maker. You can go to a university or vo-tech program or anywhere else, and what happens, those programs are great, but they only have a core of maybe two or three instructors. And in that time period, you're only going to learn what those two or three people know or their philosophies. Here, you're exposed to so many different things. The other thing I think that really adds to our master's program is the quality of the other people that are here. So while you're here in your workshop, you're with unique-minded people who are striving for the same thing that you are. They share information themselves. While you're here, there are three or four other workshops going on that you can walk around and explore and see what else is taking place. So the overall experience in terms of the education of that master's is you're with so many people who have so much passion for what they do, who are so good at what they do, that by the time you're done, the experience is unparalleled anywhere else. So this is the place if you really want to work on some kind of certificate. And that's what most of those programs are anyway, are certificates. This is the place to do it. We also have two fellowship programs. We have the Michael Fortune Fellowship, which is beyond the master's program, and we have the Alan Lacer Turning Fellowship. So those are for higher level. Those are for people who've taken already the fundamentals of the master classes, and they can work and focus specifically on these other areas of learning. We have other really cool things here. We have a friend of mine, the late Roger Cliff, passed away about a month before the towers were hit in 2001. And Roger was a PhD college professor. He was the guy who wrote the book on table saw techniques, router techniques, shaper techniques, the radial arm saw. And Roger was a good friend of mine. And when he passed so suddenly, we set up a foundation in his name. And to date, we've given away probably close to $300,000 worth of aid. So if people can't afford to come, we have a foundation that can help them find ways. We also have grant money available for people. We have an intern program. We also have money for people who are veterans. And we have a program set up specifically for youth. So we have a lot of ways to be able to help people. And again, part of that's because I've talked about our incredible instructor base. Our staff are the best there are, period. I mean, you've done things with Doug Dale and with Zane Powell. And you think about their exposure week after week, year after year, with all of these incredible instructors and students, they have to be the best that there are. So those are the kind of people that work here, and the real treasure of the school is our students. And by the time you take those groups of people together, You have a group of people who are committed to helping others. And that's why this Roger Cliff Memorial Foundation and these grants and these intern programs, are how they're funded is from these people who want to see other people have opportunities that they might not have.
I'm sure you keep track of the furthest distance people have come to the school from. Mm-hmm.
My guess is right now we've had somebody from every continent on Earth. We have a lot of international people that come here. In the very first year of the school, I had more people in attendance from California than I had from Indiana. But people come from everywhere. At one point in time, our average student used to come 500 miles away. That was the average distance people would come. It's shrunk a little bit since then. It's now down to about 300 miles, but that's the distance of the average person. But they come from absolutely everywhere. The really cool thing that we do is in each workshop, I give everybody a name tag. And it has their name that's been lasered into it. It has the class that they're in and the date. And it also says where they're from. So you can walk around and you can see where all of these people are from and what states or what countries they come from, which is just really a cool thing. So they come from everywhere. You know, something about the school, too, that I like to share is the fact that we have no corporate sponsors. And so one of the things for us, as you'll see the shop, is that there are no banners hanging on the wall. There's no patches on us. My staff and me, we are not greedy. We're in this because we really are committed to this craft. Everything we have, we pay for. Every piece of sandpaper. That way, when people come here, they're not being sold a product. They're not being pitched something. Everything we have, we've chosen and we've paid for. And I think that wholesomeness and that fact that they're not being pitched while they're here really adds more credibility to the overall experience of while they're here. Well, one of the things about trying to bring in new people for us, and one of the things that kind of affects us today is the YouTube world. Because everybody thinks that they can go to YouTube and learn about woodworking, but woodworking has so many risks. Not only the risk of physical harm, but the risk of buying equipment that might be wasteful, the risk of the natural resource of just cutting up a bunch of wood wrong. The thing about YouTube is, too, is you see somebody, but you can't ask questions. You can't interact. So you really don't know what they know. I have people who have taken my joinery class and not known anything about how wood goes together and tell me that they were going to go home and do a YouTube on how to cut a dovetail. And so what will happen is that makes them an expert. The thing that really helps us in our world is the hands-on side of things. You physically are here. You get a touch. People can direct. I mean, just holding a tool improperly can cause problems down the line. Somebody shows you the right way to do it, touches your hand, helps you do it. You'll learn more faster through those kind of experiences than you could ever learn through a video, a book, or a YouTube program. I mean, this is what it is. This is the real world here with real experiences, and they do make a difference. And woodworking is such an incredible craft, and there's so much to learn. You can cut years off the learning curve by physically being in an environment. And all of our workshops are set up, for the most part, as one-week-long workshops. So they're intensive. The shop's open 24 hours. You can stay and work all night if you want. But during that five-day period, the experience, the exposure, will not be gained somewhere else in any other way than you can have here. So we encourage people to come and start learning here, and you'll grow. So if you have no experience at all, come and take a class. And we have classes for people that are very basic and very intro. But in time, you'll desire to learn more, and you'll learn real quick, and you'll find that this is the best place to be able to do that. You know, I could, if you want, I could get into it. It might take a minute, but I could tell you how the genesis of this actually started, because it's not exactly what you would think and how you
Please.
Would think. So.
Yeah, tell us how it started.
Well, the way that the school started actually was, my undergraduate degree was in education. And the year I graduated looking for a job, they had just laid off, I'm from the center part of Indiana, they had just laid off 700 teachers in the central Indiana area, and going into education was a tough year for anybody. I did not know anything about woodworking. I'd never taken a woodworking class, and I'd never taken a business class. I wanted to coach, and I wanted to teach, and I wanted to have a youth ministry program. But the good Lord took me down a different path. And suddenly, as a kid, my father was interested in woodworking. It was a hobby of his. And he died suddenly from a heart attack about the time that I graduated from college. And he had just purchased a shopsmith. And so for me, I went ahead and decided to take over the shopsmith simply for sentimental reasons. Payments on it were 120 bucks a month. And I knew nothing about woodworking and nothing about business, and I had turned around and I was starting to work on my master's. And all of a sudden, as soon as I started to work on that machine, knowing nothing about woodworking, that passion that my father had for woodworking started to burn in me. And every waking moment I had, I was playing in a shop, learning, playing, figuring out. And I became so possessed with that everything else that I had worked for my entire life had changed, literally right there and there. And before long, I was in business, I guess, because I was paying for the machinery that I was buying, the equipment I was buying for my hobby, my passion, became an addiction. I had to buy more things. And the only way I could afford more things was to do more work. So this idea of all of a sudden I'm in business wasn't an idea. It was just simply trying to survive buying equipment. And so I went around and around, but things started to happen as I got a little bit better. I was able to buy better equipment. I was able to take on more work. With more work, I needed to hire people. As I hired people, I needed more equipment. With more equipment, I needed to take on more work, and then I needed more people. And this cycle went on and on and on. And after about 10 years, we were the largest custom shop in Indiana. And Indiana is the second largest producer of wood products in America. That landed me a job working for the government, the Western Wood Product Association, American Council on Wood and Export, and it gave me an opportunity to go lecture on the technical side of furniture making throughout the world, representing the United States. And one of the places I lectured was in a town called Damiat, Egypt. And there are 600,000 people in that town, and 400,000 of them make their living at woodworking, which you wouldn't expect. So at that, and I was there while the oil wells were still on fire from the Persian Gulf War, the first Persian Gulf War. So it was a tough time to be there, but America and 17 other countries put together this program in hopes of being able to bring business to these nations. It opened a door for us. And so everybody was involved, from the tech industry, to the wood industry, to the automobile industry, to the banking industry. And they chose experts from each of those fields to go over to represent those trades, to sell them and to help develop a economy in these different parts of the world. And everywhere we went, woodworking was not high on the list of things that people want to talk about. But in this town of Damiat, it was really interesting. I had my own interpreter with me. He was 19 years old. He was a young Egyptian man. And when we went to that town, they fed us lunch. And I wasn't really hungry that day. And before we got into town, we were on national news every day because we were the great hope coming to help them have international businesses. So TV cameras followed us. When we went to Damiat, they paraded us down the streets. And there were about 100,000 people lined the streets just to see this big group of people coming. And when they fed us lunch, the place where they fed us, there were probably 4,000 or 5,000 people around the outside just looking in to watch us because we'd been on news every day. And I wasn't really hungry, but my interpreter was from that town. The food was a little bit different. I didn't think much about it. But after that, then it was time to do our presentations. And everybody did a presentation. It wasn't just me. But woodworking was the last one to go on. And when I went on, everybody was still in the building. And as we got done, people would then come up and ask questions. So I'm in line. It's about midnight. All of these people are ready to go back to their hotel room from all these different industries, and they're waiting on me now because all these people have questions. And a guy came up to me, and he said something about, I know that when you're done with this tour, I know it's the state, but I'd like for you to come and spend time with me and my family. And I told him, I just can't. I'd already been on the road for 2 weeks internationally. I've got a business back home. I got to get back to it, and I just can't do it. And he was persistent. And all this was being communicated to me through my interpreter. And I kept telling my interpreter, don't tell him I can't do it. And it hit me. At the time, my daughter was 6 months old. I just had a new baby, and I could throw this at him. Hey, tell him I got to get home because I've got a new baby daughter. I can't wait to get home, and I just can't stay and help him. So through my interpreter, he went back. They're talking. He comes back to my interpreter, back to me. He says, okay, here's what he'd like to do. If you would be willing to come and spend just 3 days with him, he'll give you his youngest daughter. And I laughed. And my interpreter looked at me and said, you know, that's the worst thing you could have ever done. And it didn't hit me because we live here. But there, that's how they do things. And to think that somebody would be willing to give up a child to spend a few days with somebody learning more in their craft hit me hard. As I went out that night, there was a full moon. I could see the Nile. And the interpreter, this kid was an 18 or 19 year old kid, got on me really hard. He said, listen, he goes, do you know why those people were sitting around at lunchtime looking in? They weren't looking in because of you guys being, so those were people that were hungry. They had prepared the food for you to eat. And they had to borrow the money. Their family went today without eating to serve you, and you didn't even eat. And I had just insulted this guy about him offering me a child by laughing at him. And I got on the bus that night to go back to the hotel room, and I cried the entire way. And I realized that God had a calling for me that was not about making more furniture. It's about teaching and sharing my craft. I mean, that's what I did anyway. I was in the field of education. So I got back to the hotel room. I don't remember what time it was back in America, but I called my wife. And I said, hey, we're going to sell the business, and I'm going to start a school. And when you think about that, everything that we had, we'd committed in our life to the business. I mean, we literally had this great business, but we qualified for food stamps because everything we did went into that business. And to work so hard for it, and all of a sudden in a phone call say, hey, we're going to sell it, and we're going to start a school, is a tough sell. But she had confidence in me. And when I came home, I found a buyer. We sold it. It took a year and a half, and I started the school. And I started it because of an experience where overseas they were so starved for education. And we take it for granted what we have here. And I just had to share that. And I'm today as committed and as passionate about it as I could have ever been back then. And I'll be that committed and passionate about it if I live 20, 30 years from now. So that won't change. So that's really how the genesis of the school came about, was an opportunity to lecture in a third world country.
I'd never heard that story. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And I know you're still giving back every year. Yeah.
Well, we're passionate about what we do.
And that's today's episode. If you have any feedback, ideas, or something you'd like to hear about, send us an email at afterlifeoftrees@fwmedia.com. Your idea could be featured on an upcoming podcast. And thanks for listening. This episode of The Afterlife of Trees is brought to you by ShopWoodworking.com, your source for great woodworking books, videos, and project ideas from the publisher of Popular Woodworking Magazine. Sign up for email alerts on discounts, new products, and tricks of the trade at ShopWoodworking.com.